Like the office they commemorate, presidential libraries are living institutions. Certainly, it is my hope that the Reagan Library will become a dynamic intellectual forum where scholars interpret the past and policymakers debate the future.
Welcome to a Reagan Forum, hosted by the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute. The Center for Public Affairs offers lectures and forums presenting perspectives on important public policy issues of the day, from politicians, authors, members of the media, business and military leaders, and more. In this week's Reagan Forum, we go back 1 month to our in-person program with former U.S. Navy SEAL sniper and number one New York Times bestselling author, Jack Carr. Jack joined us to discuss the release of his latest book, which is the fifth in his James Reese novel series, In the Blood. Jack Carr led special operations teams as a team leader, platoon commander, troop commander, and task unit commander. He later became a Navy SEAL sniper, leading assault and sniper teams in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he later commanded a special operations task unit in the most Iranian-influenced section of southern Iraq throughout the drawdown of U.S. forces. Following his years in service of our country, he became a thriller novelist, applying the experience and emotions from real-world combat to the pages of his novels. During our program, Jack sat down in conversation with Reagan Foundation and Institute Chief Learning Officer Tony Penny to discuss his James Reese novels. Let's listen.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, here we go. All right, thank you guys. Thank you everybody for being here. Michael Reagan, I mean, oh my goodness. And Cameron, so before we start, I just gotta say, so I have an email newsletter that goes out, and it got really big over the last few years, and so I don't see them really anymore. But one day I just went there real quick, and I just did that with my finger, and all these names popped up, and I saw Reagan. I was like, click. And yeah, Cameron, thank you for reaching out. That was so amazing. Really cool. Sincerely appreciate it. And Stacy, thank you for being here. Amazing. I don't know who's going to see that cake that you made in the back that's all edible, that looks like my books and a typewriter that a fan sent me that used to belong to Hemingway, which is crazy. And Rick Rosenfield over there, thank you so much for being here. And Marty Katz, thank you for being here as well. It's great to see familiar faces. And everybody at the library, thanks for having me tonight.
Excellent. Yeah, no, thank you very much. So we're going to have some time for audience questions at the end. So if you have a burning question you want to ask Jack about his book or about what's next for him, we'll have staff going around in a little bit. But before we do that, I want to dive in. So as I mentioned, I'm a literature major, and I'm really interested in the art of creation, right? And before we get into the story, I want to hear a little bit of your creation story and how it was that you came to be. You've gone down two very different pathways, both of which you've been remarkably successful at. But let's start with the first one. You know, what was your original pathway? How did you find yourself serving our country?
Yeah, so I think that was just, it was innate. It was just something that was in me from a very early age. There was never anything else other than write that I wanted to do, but my first draw was the military. And I think that had a lot to do with just, other than it just being in me in the blood from the beginning, is that my grandfather served in World War II, and he was killed off Okinawa in 1945, in May of 1945, when two kamikazes hit the aircraft carrier USS Bunker Hill. And he was in the ready room, actually, writing a letter to his wife at the time, and the first kamikaze was almost a direct hit on the deck above the ready room. So I had the silk maps that they used to give aviators back then, because if you had plastic map or paper maps, it would just disintegrate in the water. So you had these silk maps that they got wet, they still worked. I had pictures of him and his squadron. He flew the Corsair, which is that plane that had the gull wings that would fold up and fit on the aircraft carrier. So I had pictures of that plane. Baba Black Sheep was on TV, Black Sheep Squadron, for those who remember Robert Conrad playing Pappy Boynton in that show that ran for two seasons. And so my dad and I would watch that together, and that's the power of popular culture, is that that was his touch point with his dad, because he never met him, and my touch point with that generation as well. So I was just always drawn to military service. And then at the ripe old age of 7, I found out about SEALs. And I found out about SEALs on a movie, once again, power of popular culture. A movie called The Frogmen, for anybody who remembers that one, Richard Widmark, and it's an old black and white film from 1951. And back in the 80s, I was the remote control. For those who grew up back then, you remember there was no remote control, the kids were the remote. And there was ABC, CBS, NBC, and then that one outlier channel that would always play a war movie on Sundays. So as my dad would watch football, when it came time for a commercial break, he would look at his watch and say, go, and I'd run up and flip it to that outlier channel, and there'd always be some war movie on, and I'd watch it for 2 minutes, and then he'd say, flip it back. And so then I'd wait for the the next commercial break because I didn't really care about football. I cared about that war movie, and one of them was the Frogmen. And I asked my dad, hey, what are these guys? Because I saw them climbing up over these beaches and putting explosives on these obstacles, and I thought, that looks pretty cool. And he said, go ask your mother, because I was interrupting football. And so I went and asked my mom, and she was a librarian, still is. And so we went down to the local library and did some research. And there wasn't very much you could research on SEALs back in the early 80s. You could actually read it all. And I remember the takeaways that I had back then were that SEALs are some of the most elite special operators in the world, and the training is some of the toughest ever devised by a modern military. So at age 7, I was like, okay, that's it. The recruiter's job was done at that point. And then I just kept my eye on that ball. And so I was always going to serve in our nation's military, and special operations were the draw, particularly the SEAL teams. So that's what I did.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. And so I was going to ask you about your second pathway, which is to authorhood. Yeah. And I'm guessing it has something to do with your mom being a librarian.
It does. It does. And it's also connected to the first. Because even back then, I started reading. We had an encyclopedia collection. Every few years, we get a new set of encyclopedias. And I'd always go to World War II, or I'd go to Korea, or I'd go to Vietnam, anything that had anything to do with warfare. And I'd go and I'd read those sections, and then I'd try to research as much as I could at age 7, 8, 9, 10, as much as I possibly could. But there was a finite amount almost back then on terrorism, on insurgencies, on counterinsurgencies. So I just tried to soak all of that in. I still have a lot of the books that I collected back then. They're still part of my collection today. But at about age 10, I started reading the books that my parents were reading, and that's when Hunt for Red October came out. And by sixth grade, for sure, I was reading everything, like adult fiction. But fifth grade, Hunt for Red October comes out, and then I find David Morrell, and I find A.J. Quinnell, I find J.C. Pollock, I find Mike Olden, Nelson DeMille. I find all these guys who have protagonists with backgrounds that I want to have in real life. So typically back then, everybody remembers TV from the 80s and movies from the 80s. The action hero typically was a Marine sniper in Vietnam, Army Special Forces in Vietnam, Navy SEAL in Vietnam, CIA paramilitary in Vietnam, something in Vietnam. And so that's the background that I wanted. So I started reading all those books, and I had such a magical experience in those pages in sixth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade, all through high school, that continues today. So I really gave myself an education in the art of storytelling. And then in high school, 1988, Bill Moyers does a series of interviews on PBS, the Power of Myth, it was called. And so I got to really delve into that, the mythology and the hero's journey. And I had a connection there because how it influenced George Lucas and Star Wars. And to a kid, I was just like, oh my gosh, it's amazing. So I really looked at everything through the lens of that hero's journey from then on. And I didn't really look at it at the time as studying. It was just something that I loved to do. So I'm coming to it from the fan's perspective. And later in life, it would really help out to have that foundation built back then, because I'm reading these things in 1983, 84, 85, 86, as they're very current, and before I have too much cynicism built up from years of experience, and I'm just having this magical time in these pages. And that's what I try to do today, is write the book with the same kind of heart that I was reading as a kid.
So was there any big discrepancies? So if you look at the way popular culture portrays these military heroes, I think of, I'm a kid of the 80s too, so I'm thinking like Rambo or something like that, right? And versus your experience, when you get into it, what you thought the experience in service was going to be versus what it actually was when you started going through SEAL training, which is notoriously some of the most difficult training that any humans can go through, right? So was there a discrepancy there?
There was. I realized you had to actually aim your rifle to hit something. And for those of you who have shot, you know that in the 80s, everything was from down here. No one was ever aiming. No one really brought it up to their shoulder. One of the first movies actually where guys start bringing that rifle to their shoulders is actually Navy SEALs in the early 90s. And for whatever reason, they had a technical advisor that had the guys bring the MP5s at the time, submachine guns up. And it became more prevalent after that. But there's still a lot of this in the 90s. There's still a lot of not aiming, because the actors, for those of you who have experience in Hollywood, they like to show their face. So they gotta be down. Gotta be like this, you know, like that. Not like this, because you can't see them from that camera angle. So there's a lot of that going on. But yeah, so that was probably one of the bigger discrepancies. But all of those things, like those characters were almost mentors back then. And I think it's harder to find I think, action heroes today in films that you want your kids to look up to, because there's so much anti-hero stuff out there. But back in the 80s, growing up with Rocky and with Rambo and Commando and Predator, I mean, that's what you wanted to be, is larger than life heroes, and you looked up to, and you didn't know back then that you actually needed to aim to hit something. It was just all fantastic. And then same thing in the pages of those novels. Like David Morrell with Brotherhood of the Rose, he really combines the UK spy fiction tradition of John le Carré with the US spy fiction tradition of Robert Ludlum, and kind of combine those two for the first time, Brotherhood of the Rose, and then the novels that came after. But I loved reading those books, and I thought, these guys probably did their research, because you can't check. You couldn't get online and check anything. Now, people will let you know if you get anything wrong. Yeah, they will definitely tell you. But back then, you just had to trust that the author did his research and got it right. So yeah, there's discrepancies, but more important than that was just the inspiration that those movies and those books and TV shows gave that our generation to go and serve. And I think that was the power of popular culture used to be our most powerful export, Hollywood. And that's shifted a little bit over the years, I think.
Yeah. Well, when did you first start writing? Were you writing, were you keeping journals when you were deployed overseas? Or when did you first start picking up the pen or your Hemingway typewriter?
So I was always in junior high school. I always enjoyed writing. I loved it. I got a writing award here in California, actually. Yeah. The Promising Young Writers Award for 1988. Breaking news here. I've never told anyone. My mom has it in the attic somewhere, and she was very proud. So I was always good at that. Even from a young age, and but I didn't study how to do anything. I came to it from the fan's perspective of having built up all those years of reading and giving myself the education that way. But I wasn't writing, I wasn't journaling, although I hear it's very important to journal and meditate and breathe and exercise and eat right, all these things you're supposed to do, but at that point your day's over. I don't know how you're supposed to get any writing done if you're doing all that sort of a thing. But eventually I'll have to get better at some of those things and start exercising and eating right again. But no, I didn't journal, I didn't practice any writing, because when I was in, my sole focus was on being the best operator and the best leader that I could possibly be. But I was still studying warfare, I'm still studying terrorism and insurgencies and counterinsurgencies, lessons learned from downrange, what is the enemy doing, how are they adapting to us, because war is this constant game of adaptation back and forth. So I was always studying those things, and then I was always reading on the side. So as I joined the military, then there's the Gabriel Alon series that kicks off in the late 90s. Vince Flynn has Term Limits. Then Brad Thor comes along. So these, I keep reading because I just love that escape. But it's not really an escape, because I'm doing the same thing I was doing as when I was young, is thinking, hey, these guys probably did some research into X, Y, or Z, into a terrorist organization or a weapon system or whatever it might be. So it's still an education. And I didn't really realize how much of an education in writing and storytelling it was until I started writing, and then I thought, oh my goodness, I'm so glad that I have this, all these years of reading experience under my belt in order to then take that step and write. So I knew what I liked, knew what I didn't, had a natural aptitude for it. I loved it. I loved creating everything from the title to the theme to the one-page executive summary to the outline to the story. I love the editing process. I love every part of this.
Yeah, well, it's evident. I mean, you definitely have a talent for crafting a story and for telling. I mean, just I was reading this and I couldn't stop, turning the page. And every chapter, it gets to that last sentence. You're like, oh gosh, now I got to figure out what's going on next. So it's evident that the way you approach the craft of writing, there's a lot there and a lot of thought.
Thank you.
And you've obviously studied the masters. Now, I was reading somewhere that your initial book, so your first book, was published in 2018.
2018.
So how did you get from, okay, I've been into the service for 20 years. Now I'm going to write a book. What was the transition there from that to?
Yeah, so I came back from my last deployment to Iraq. We shut down Iraq at the end of 2011, U.S. forces out of there, and I hadn't been to a shore duty yet, so they sent me to BUDS, which is SEAL training. And really my last deployment to Iraq was the last one where I would tactically lead and maneuver guys on the battlefield. If I stayed in, I would come back eventually as a commanding officer after a couple staff jobs here and there. And commanding officer sounds very impressive, especially a SEAL commanding officer, but really any commanding officer, any O5 in the military today is really leading from a tactical operations center. I mean, they're not out there on the front lines kicking in the doors with the guys, calling in airstrikes, doing any of that sort of thing. And you don't want them doing that because they've been in these staff positions for the last 5, 6, 7 years. So they're not current But I knew that that was the last time doing what I came in to do, and it was time to get out. My family needed me. We still have a special needs son who needs 24/7 full-time care forever. My wife had been taking care of him the whole time that, since he was born, and it was time to get out and take care of them. So those two things kind of came together at the same time, not leading guys tactically on the battlefield anymore, and my family needing me. So I picked my head up and took a breath and thought, okay, what am I gonna do next year? Well, all my whole life I've wanted to write thrillers. That's what I'll do. So I had a couple more years left in the military. So I knew what I was going to do, but I didn't actually start writing quite yet. So like a couple years, like 2 years of that staff job at Buds as the operations officer, which is like the COO of a company. You're kind of running day-to-day operations, but at a training command, all the different phases of training and the instructors, like they have it down. Like they don't need you messing around. They've been doing this for quite some time. So you have a little time on your hands. So I got to take a breath. And also in that job, I saw people would call me all the time. So as the operations officer and kind of maneuvering things on in the training compound there, people would call and ask me, hey, can I come back and give my boss a tour? Or hey, can I give so-and-so a tour? Can I show so-and-so Buds? And I always said, absolutely. And sometimes the commanding officers didn't really like that, so I just figured a time when they weren't gonna be there and do it anyway. Because I just wanted to help these guys out. But what I saw is that they kind of couldn't move on. They had this foundation in the SEAL teams, but I saw a lot of people that got stuck in that cement, they got stuck in that foundation because they couldn't figure out, hey, what their next passion was, their next mission was, and put those together to figure out what their purpose was going forward. So I got to see that and then think to myself, oh, I better be able to articulate what I want to do next. And so my passion is writing, my mission is taking care of my family, and so I now have my purpose in life moving forward as those two things combine and go together. So as I started to get out, that's about a year and a half, 2 years before I got out. For those who have been in the military, you know when you drop your papers, then you go on a different pile. So you've told the military you're getting out, and all of a sudden you're not on this track to do whatever they had planned for you to do, and you go in this other pile that's kind of like, I guess he's getting out pile. And that means you have to go to medical, and you have to go to dental, and you have to turn in gear and get read out of secret programs. And before you do any of those things, you need to stand in line to make your appointment to do those things, because it's military and gigantic bureaucracy. So you have time. And that's really when I started formulating the story. And what I did was write about 5, 6, 7, 8 different one-page executive summaries, put them on the table, and it was very evident that the terminal list had to come first. It jumped right out at me, had a title right away, and I really wanted to write the third one, Savage Son, because in sixth grade I read Most Dangerous Game by Richard Connell, and that's a short story, and even in sixth grade I thought one day I will write a thriller that pays tribute to that short story. So I wanted to start with that one, but I knew that the characters weren't developed enough yet for that theme. So that's really exploring the dark side of man through the dynamic of hunter and hunted. And so I knew I couldn't start with that. I had to start with the terminal list, and I knew it was the one that was most likely to get noticed by a New York publishing company. And then those books that I read also, I noticed that a few people had mentioned somebody named Emily Bessler in the back. And so Brad Thor is saying thank you to her, and Vince Flynn is saying thank you to her. And so I decided that Emily Bessler shall be my publisher and editor, even though she had no idea who I was. And then I started writing, and that's how got the terminal list as good as it could possibly go. And I had a little help along the way too. And it was from Brad Thor, and he is what amazing author you guys have probably read, but he's been here on this exact stage. And a friend had sat next to Brad at a foundation dinner for one of these SEAL foundations, and they got to know each other, and he'd helped Brad out with the SEAL character in some of his books. And so this friend who I'd been in the SEAL teams with called me and said, hey, do you want to talk to Brad Thor? And I said, would he talk to me? And he said, yeah, let me set it up. He owes me a favor. I'm like, okay. And so set up a call, and I was here, I was in Los Angeles, and when I got the call, and I was in my old Land Cruiser, so those who have Land Cruisers know that they're very loud, and so I turned off the AC, it was in the corner of this parking lot, and the sun was just beating down, I was just soaking wet, and I had this yellow legal pad there, and had this call with Brad Thor, and started taking all these notes. And as I took those notes, he was like, finally, he's like, stop talking. Like I was talking about my mom, and I always wanted to write, and all these things, and he had another book to write. And he said, hey, your friend told me some of the things that you did in the SEAL teams, and as a thank you for those things, if you write a book, I will let Emily Bessler at Simon & Schuster know that it's coming. He said, I can't guarantee that she'll like it, can't guarantee she'll even open it or read one word, but I can let her know. And I said, that's all I need. And he said, when's it gonna be done? And I said, a year from today. And so that was my first deadline. So he said, don't call me back. I'm not gonna give you any advice. I'm not gonna read any chapters, which I appreciate him telling me that, because now I get how many people wanna send you chapters of books to read. And so I called him back a year later, and he remembered me. And And he said, hey, is it done or is it as good as you can get it? And I said, well, it's done. I kind of came sliding into home plate here, though, to make my first deadline. And he said, well, call me back when it's as good as you can get it. So I spent another 4 months editing. And then I called him back and said, it's as good as I can get it. He said, okay, I'll let her know it's coming. And in that first call, I had written down, somehow I weaved in, so those of you who have been in intelligence circles know about the solicitation type of thing and running human networks. And I worked in somehow the font that Emily Bessler likes, the margins that she likes, the spacing that she likes, how she likes it, doesn't like it bound or anything. So I sent it to her exactly the way that she would like to receive a manuscript. So, you know, those little things, who knows how much they helped, but I did all those things. And she ended up liking it, and then off we go to the races.
Yeah. Well, what about, I mean, so obviously your main character, James Reese, who's now kind of sustained through five books, so it's not just a one-off, right? There's enough there to get five best-selling books out of it. I've read some reviews of your books that say it's modeled a little bit, you know, kind of autobiographical, but I've also heard you say, well, not quite. So where did the genesis of James Reese come from?
Yeah, I mean, he's a background very similar to mine in that he's a former SEAL enlisted sniper, so he has that background. Then he becomes an officer. And then when the reader meets him in the first novel, he's at that same place I was really when I was getting out, in that he was not going to tactically lead guys on the battlefield. He's on his last deployment. His family needs him. And then from there on out, it really becomes all fiction. But yeah, the background is similar. And that helps because I don't have to interview a SEAL about it and then kind of think about it and then fictionalize it. I just get to remember what Buzz was like and throw a story in. Or I get to remember what Ramadi was like or Baghdad was like or what the Hindu Kush was like. And I just get to put those things in there and weave the sights and the sounds and the smells and the feeling and the camaraderie and all of that in there. I don't have to make that part up. So that part's real and those are memories and I get to use them in a positive way going forward. So they resonate. I think that's what made the book resonate with Emily when she read it for the first time, is because of those emotions and those feelings.
And then as the book's taken off, right? I mean, there's lots of people out there who write and want to be writers and it never goes anywhere. You get your first book, you get it in front of the publisher you want to get it in front of, it takes off, right? It's doing really well. And in fact, coming out in is it next month or 2 months from now? It's going to be a TV series,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, we have Chris Pratt playing the lead role, Navy SEAL sniper James Reese coming July 1st to Amazon Prime Video.
Yeah. And how is that? You come up with a character in your mind, and not too long after, you're like, oh, Chris Pratt is going to step in and be this person that I thought of in my mind. I mean, what's that feeling like?
Yeah, well, it was kind of the same way as I thought Emily Bessler would be my publisher, in that as I was writing, I thought, hey, Chris Pratt will play this lead role. And that's kind of strange because he hadn't been in Guardians of the Galaxy, had not been in Jurassic World, had not been in the Avengers. So he was this lovable Andy Dwyer kind of overweight guy in Parks and Rec. But then he had a small role in Zero Dark Thirty as a SEAL. So the movie about the hunt for Bin Laden. And I saw the transformation that he made from being that overweight, lovable Andy Dwyer character on TV to Navy SEAL. And I thought, this is somebody that he hasn't done a role like this before. And of course, no one knows who I am. I have no touch points yet in Hollywood or in New York publishing. I'm just sitting there in a tiny little office closet off our bedroom in Coronado, still in the military as I'm typing away. But it seems very natural to think of these things as a child of the 80s. And so I never gave it any thought, like, what if Chris doesn't want to play this role? That did never enter my mind. What if Emily doesn't want to publish this? But I never even really thought about that. And I thought, someone like Chris needs to do this, because I thought, once again, back to the 80s, of Tom Hanks. And in the 80s, all he did was comedy, and then he takes a risk with Philadelphia. And then after Philadelphia, he can do whatever he wants. And I thought, that's the kind of actor that I need for this. Someone who's likable, because he's going to do some things, and I want the audience to want to still have a beer with this guy or sit down and have coffee with him. If they're going to spend time in the pages of the book, I want that to be the case as well, because you're spending time that you're never going to get back with somebody in the pages of this book or as you listen on audio. So I think it's good to spend time with someone you like and is generally likable. So I thought of Chris Pratt playing the role. And I also thought of Antoine Fuqua directing. Which is crazy, because of course it makes sense. I've already chosen my publisher, I've already chosen my A-list actor, so might as well choose my director.
Sure.
So I choose Antoine Fuqua, although he doesn't know me yet. And I chose him because I loved what he did with Tears of the Sun, and I love Shooter, which is based on Point of Impact by Stephen Hunter, who's an author that's incredible, dear friend now. Of course, Antoine did Training Day as well, but I thought he'll direct. And so sure enough, Chris is starring, Antoine is directing, and we're all three executive producers on it. But once again, it came back to something that I didn't even realize at the time would make a difference, and I actually forgot about it. And before the first book came out, so in November of 2017, so a few months before the book comes out, a SEAL buddy calls that I hadn't talked to in 5 years. And first, I'm on a range up in Oregon at Thunder Ranch doing some training, and he calls and asks if I remember him. And I said, yes, Jared, of course I remember you. And he said, well, do you remember what you did for me in the SEAL teams? And I did not. And he said, well, as I was getting out, you're the only person that sat me down in your office, talked to me about moving into the private sector. You introduced me to people in the private sector, and I've always wanted to thank you. And I said, no problem. And he said, I said, how's it going? And he said, it's going great, but I heard you have a book coming out. And I said, yep, it's coming out in a few months. I have this thing called a galley, and I learned what a galley was like a week earlier, and it's like a rough draft, you know, that goes out to reviewers. And he said, yeah, that'd be great. I'd love to take a look, but I'd also like to give it to a friend of mine. And I said, who's that? And he said, Chris Pratt. And so I said, oh, that's, what, how convenient. So he read it first to make sure it wasn't garbage, and then he gave it to Chris in December of 2017. Chris read it the last week in December and called the next week and optioned it. And at the same time, another SEAL buddy, Mark Owen, who wrote No Easy Day, for those of you who have read that book, he had gotten to know Antoine Fuqua. And he gave the manuscript to Antoine, and Antoine wanted it at the exact same time as Chris. And so finally, they started talking to each other, and Antoine calls Chris and says, hey, let's do this thing together. So now we're all doing it together.
Wow, it's just a really, really incredible. Hey, congratulations on that.
More from our Reagan Forum with Jack Carr after this message.
The Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation is the nonprofit organization created by President Reagan himself, and specifically charged by him with continuing his legacy and sharing his principles: individual liberty, economic opportunity, global democracy, and national pride. We must remain vigilant and work together to share these conservative principles with younger generations. Your role is critical to move our mission forward. Thank you for your continued support. Please visit reaganfoundation.org/give. That's reaganfoundation.org/give.
Now, back to our Reagan Forum with Jack Carr.
So I want to talk about In the Blood.
Yes.
But I want to do it in such a way, I don't want to give away any spoilers, right? You all need to read this book, and if you start reading it tonight, you'll be done by breakfast tomorrow. You won't be able to put it down. But I want to do it in a way that I don't give away. So there's lots of key plot points, and I don't want to do that. So I'm going to come at it thematically, and I want to ask you a couple of questions about, I told you I'm a lit major, so I got thematic questions that are going to come at you. So one of the things that pops up over and over again thematically is this issue of time. Mm. Right, you have it in the Rolex that Reese is wearing, which is not just tells time, but it's a connection to a former time, a connection to his father. He's thinking constantly about the timing behind things, right? He has this mantra that he says several times: slow is smooth, smooth is fast, right? So you have kind of this repetitive kind of references to time throughout. Are you consciously thinking about that as you write that, or is that something that's really important in the world for James Reese?
It's something that I think about personally, and I have since I was very young. I remember being just fascinated with watches from a very early age, and also fascinated with time. I've never really worn, like, I can't do the Apple Watch or those kind of things. And I remember they started giving us these watches in the teams, the early Garmins that would have a compass in there. But the early ones, you had about an hour's worth of time. So I guess if you're gonna be outside the wire on a mission for an hour, it was good. But other than that, you had to plug those things back in. They're a lot better now, of course. But I always had this, I always loved thinking about time, because it's something that all of us have in common. And it's the one thing that really that binds us all together, because we all have a limited amount of it, and we don't know how much time we have, and we also get to choose how we're going to spend that time, who we're going to spend it with, who we're going to influence. So I spent a lot of time thinking about that, and have from a very early age. I remember seeing my dad's old Rolex that he got in the 60s in Europe, going through Europe, and I was always fascinated by that watch. And then I always just noticed watches in films, like in Magnum, for those of you who are Magnum fans in the 80s, the Rolex that he wore. So I've just always been fascinated with time personally, and then watches because of the art and just how the mechanics and just the craftsmanship that goes into these things. So those people are spending their time working on a timepiece and putting this energy, all their energy and effort into making a work of art that you can wear that reminds you that you only have a limited amount of time and you get to choose how you're going to spend that. So time's something that's very important to me, so it just became something that was important to my character, but also something that he thinks about because of his limited time with his father. He didn't know that his dad was going to not come back from a mission down to Argentina, and so his dad was killed down there, so it's something that he thinks about as well, and he has this timepiece, and it's a Rolex Submariner, because I knew you could get a Submariner and a GMT in 1968 in Saigon, but I really like the Sea. I was going to try to do the Sea Dweller, but I didn't have any connections to Rolex at the time, so I couldn't find out if you could have gotten the Sea Dweller in the PX in Saigon in 1968, so if I had figured that out, then it would probably be a Sea Dweller, but it's a Submariner, and so I just have this connection to time, and for this book, it's been in all the books, but in this one in particular, it really comes into play.
Yeah, absolutely. There's also, you quote Wyatt Earp in there too, fast is fine, but accuracy is final.
Nice work. Well done.
I loved it. Another big theme that really pops up in this one is technology. And kind of that razor edge. I remember when I was in high school, I had this great history teacher who came up and he drew two lines on the board. One was about twice as tall as the other. And he said, the tall one, he's like, this is how fast humans can advance technology. And the shorter one was, this is how fast humans understand the implications of what that technology.
Wow.
And I thought about that when I was reading your book, because there are a lot of kind of dangerous and scary implications about technology, everything from AI to data to how, you know, foreign adversaries are using intelligence and data kind of both against us and that sort of thing. So I'd love just to hear you expand a little bit on that too and why that's important in this work.
Yeah, so there's something I didn't have a touch point with in the military. I don't know why. I thought a quantum computer was just a really big computer. And those of you, if you haven't seen what a quantum computer is, you should type it into your browser later this evening and hit images and check out what a quantum computer actually looked like, because it's amazing. And I loved having to describe it in the book for someone who had never seen it before. So I describe it as this Medusa of wires intertwined. It hangs in a vacuum. But it's really interesting, just visually stunning. It looks like a piece of art, actually. So for me, in the last book, the first book, I'd been to the places that I write about. I'd been to Iraq, been to Afghanistan, had the touch points. It's with all the things that were going on in that first novel. Second one, same thing. I needed to go to a couple other places. I had to go to Mozambique. I'd already been to Morocco. I'd already been to Ukraine. So I used those in there, and it worked geographically for that novel. For the next one, it's still hunting and shooting and revenge and tracking and all these things that I kind of have a firm grasp of, or semi-firm grasp of, or at least I know who to call, and just to confirm a few things. Went to Kamchatka Peninsula, Russia for that one. But for the one before this, for The Devil's Hand, I really didn't have any touch point with bioweapons research, bioweapons defense research. So I had to go deep down the rabbit hole and do a ton of research for that book. And the same thing held true for this one. No touch point with quantum computing, with artificial intelligence, with mass data storage and what that really means. Surveillance of US citizens, only really scratching the surface with what I see in the news here and there, Edward Snowden's book or that sort of a thing. But I went deep down the rabbit hole into quantum computing, into the national security side of quantum computing in this book, into artificial intelligence for this one. And essentially, when you read something on those topics, it's already dated. It's already, because technology is moving forward so quickly. So when you read and research this, it just gives you a foundation from which to ask other people who are much more current, educated questions. And so you have this foundation reading books that are already dated. You can ask these questions. You can kind of understand some of the language if you're me anyway. Somebody else will be able to understand it a lot more. But you have to interview a lot of people, because nobody really wants to tell you what's going on in that field. Or they want to maybe give you a hint. And you're like, okay, like a journalist. So the last two books, I really felt like a journalist, researching that bioweapon stuff for the last one, doing the quantum computing and artificial intelligence stuff for this one. I felt like I was a journalist putting together this puzzle. And so one person tells you one thing, and you get that in there. And then one person tells you something different, but leaves out what this person said. That goes in there. And so you start building this, putting this puzzle together, painting this mosaic, putting it all together. And I think what I have in here is very close. I'd be shocked if it's not almost exactly like what we have in the particular place that I do describe in this novel. And what each and every one of those people that I interviewed told me is that, hey, we could tell you more, but it would put your book in the science fiction category. So it was much more frightening to do that than it was to do the bioweapons research for the last book.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
I mean, it is scary, and the implications, and I mean, technology.
We're not recording this, are we?
Yeah.
Good.
Well, according to your book, somebody's listening somewhere. We're being live streamed, right? So, and then, of course, this idea of retribution, vengeance, and violent resolution, right? I mean, this is one of the primary drivers for Reese throughout all the books is this idea of kind of settling scores and doing what's right. He reminds me of kind of like a Spartan warrior, right? Yeah. In some sense, where he's out defending what's right, and he has these enemies on all sides, both within the power structure above. Yeah. He never knows who he can trust. Why is that so important to you as an author to explore that theme?
I think because I can't do these things in real life because I go to jail. So I get to do them in the pages of a thriller, and it's very therapeutic in a lot of too. You can explore a lot. And I think it's just something that, there's a reason that there are 5, 6, 7, 8 Death Wish movies that span decades now. So there's just something that brings us back to that theme of revenge. There's something very primal about it. And it's been that way from the beginning of time, telling stories around that campfire. And typically when that happened back in the earliest of days, that was to pass on a lesson. And it was to pass on the lesson of the hunt so that the next generation could take that lesson and continue to feed the family and the tribe, or lessons of war. So they wouldn't have to learn those same lessons in blood, and they could continue their own bloodline, their own lineage. So those themes pop up in all of the novels as well, because it's something I think of quite a bit. And I think people started to think about a little more maybe at the beginning of COVID, when we realized that society, even here, is a little fragile, because we've had so many years of relative peace. When you look at all of human history, there's only a very slim portion of it where you could call 911, or when you didn't have to be good at hunting or didn't have to be good at fighting. And the only reason we're all here today is because we had relatives that were good at both of those things, or ancestors that were good at both of those things. So when we have something like a COVID scare, and you realize that, oh, wait a sec, there's not gonna be food in the grocery store, or wait, if I call 911, maybe the fire department's not gonna show up, or a police officer's not gonna show up. Maybe I should take some personal responsibility here and get prepared and be ready, or as ready as I can be, ready as makes sense for my family and where we live. But as things start to get back to normal, then it takes a little effort to do those sorts of things, and we're very comfortable in this country being comfortable, and we haven't had to be uncomfortable for quite some time. But even if you remember the day before the Russians invaded Ukraine, interviews on the street, and most people were like, I don't think it's going to happen, we're fine, and then look what we have today. So it's society is very fragile, and it just, you don't have to be paranoid, but it just makes sense to maybe be prepared, and as citizens, I think it's our responsibility to be prepared and not rely on our government for those things.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the Soviet Union. You have a couple characters, Russian characters in this book, and there's one towards the beginning, and he's kind of ruminating and thinking about the West. I'm going to pull this up. I want to read this directly, because obviously here at the Reagan Library, we think about the Cold War, and we think about the status of it. This is kind of interesting. Your character, Gromyko, is that the pronunciation? Gromyko?
The pronunciations are interesting in that I just read them all the time, and then I don't really know how to pronounce a lot of them. So that becomes the job of my narrator, Ray Porter, who does all the narration in the audiobooks. So often I just have a good-looking name that makes sense, and maybe the last letter isn't the same as somebody else, so you try to work that in there so they're different enough. But oftentimes I don't know how to actually pronounce a lot of the names that I write in the novels. Thank you for asking me that question.
Oh, there we go. My apologies.
We can edit that out.
Yeah, take that one out. It's off the record. All right. So he's thinking about the West. He's thinking about the Cold War. And he said, he's thinking this. The West believed they had won. It was the belief that allowed them to let down their guard, focus inward, find the wrongs in their society, and exploit and even exacerbate them for political gain. It was a myopic strategy. He had expected more of his Cold War rival. That they did not study or learn from their history did not bode well for their future. The death of the West, the USSR, hadn't needed ballistic missile submarines or a nuclear arsenal larger than the United States. All they had needed to defeat the Americans was patience. That was scary to read as an American.
I know, that was depressing to write. depressing to hear you read.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's tough because my wife and I, we sit down at the end of the day and have a glass of wine on the couch, and we're thinking about what freedoms we're passing on to this next generation, and what our responsibilities are as parents, as citizens, obviously, in safeguarding those freedoms that were given to us by people who sacrificed everything so we could have the options and opportunities we have today. But a lot of what I see happening in the country I mean, it's told through the eyes and the voice of our enemy in here. I did that in a similar thing in the last book as well, because you look at the nation and if you apply some common sense to what's going on, there are a few very obvious things that we could correct that would make us stronger as a whole going forward. And we neglect to do that because, I think the divisiveness obviously helps certain people in circles and tech companies and in politics to galvanize bases, and it makes sense to keep them, to keep us divided for that reason. And it's easier to do with social media, obviously. But yeah, it's depressing to write in it. Sometimes it's tough to look out there over the landscape that is the country today, because I see what the enemy is talking about right here. And for the last book also, I put myself in the enemy's shoes, and the theme of that book was really, what has the enemy learned by watching us on the field of battle for the last 20 years at war? But as I started to write it, COVID hit. So I'm like, okay, if I am Russia, if I am China, if I am North Korea, I'm Iran, I'm a super empowered individual, I'm a terrorist organization, what am I learning from the United States response to COVID? And then we hit a summer of civil unrest. And okay, if I'm the enemy, I'm certainly taking lessons. Then a very contentious political season and election cycle. These are things that the enemy is not just watching and passing, they are taking lessons and applying them. And in doing that research, I thought, oh geez, if I was the enemy, I might just watch for a little bit, because we're doing a pretty good job of destroying ourselves from within right now. And so as an author, then I have to, if that's my conclusion, I have to figure out a way around that, because I just can't leave that the book. I can't have the enemy just sitting there. They have to do something. So I'm like, oh geez. So I had to figure out a way to propel the plot forward. And I like, that was a fun creative exercise to figure out how to make that happen.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to have one more question. I want to make sure we have time for any audience questions. So I'm going to end with one final thing I was thinking about as I was reading it, as Reese, obviously death happens quite a bit, right? Violent resolutions. But Reese is a character who, both literally and figuratively, is kind of walking through graveyards. On one hand, he's visiting his father's gravesite. He's creating his own graveyards as he kind of goes about the world, getting retribution. But he also, even in the way he thinks, he's constantly back and forth between the present, and he has the voices of, you know, if you look back to the first novel, his wife and his daughter and his colleagues who were in that initial kind of inciting incident in the first book. Is this a character who can ever escape that cycle of death and kind of constantly being in between the two worlds of the living and the dead?
Ooh, that's a great question, but it's more the memories and the lessons that those people have to pass along. Whether there were lessons like his dad's passing along actively that he's thinking back on in this one in particular, or if it's just memories of things that happened, like with his family, and what does that mean for him going forward? Does he even want to learn to live again? And what is that next purpose for him? What's his next mission? What's his next passion? Can he do that? So those things all coincide, and I think it's a very natural thing to do, because it's something that I think about. I think about the lessons that were passed on to me from the Vietnam generation, things that were passed on to me from some of the first guys that went into Afghanistan. And they came back and wanted to pass on lessons to us so we wouldn't have to relearn some of their mistakes that they learned in the battlefield. So I think about those lessons a lot, and I think about people that sacrificed and so that I wouldn't have to, or that I could. And then my goal as a leader was always to have the people coming up behind me do it better than I had done it for them. So it's that passing on of lessons so we can all grow stronger, whether it's as a team or a country. So that's a part of me, and so it becomes a part of my character as well. And I think I really liked in other books that I read and other movies, and I just, there was something about those flashback scenes when someone's passing along something to that next generation, like we talked about around the fire earlier, and then thinking back on that and saying, oh, I can tap into that and use it going forward, maybe morph it a little bit, maybe adapt it a little bit because times have changed and things are moving forward. So I do like to do that, and I think it's just a natural part of what I do in normal, everyday life, and so it naturally makes its way into the novel as well.
Yeah, no, that's great. All right, well, I want to, if anybody has a question, we have a couple of our staff members who have microphones that are walking around. Looks like we have one up in front here, so maybe we'll come up here and we can just...
I guess as they're walking, yeah. I want to go back to one thing that you mentioned earlier about that process, because you can really use it for anything. But when I start off these things, I start them all off the same way that I did those first ones, was with that one-page executive summary, kind of like the flap jacket on the book in the back there. And so I read that and I say, okay, do I want to spend a year of my life devoted to this theme, to this story? And if the answer to that is yes, then the next question is, hey, if someone else was to read this, would they then want to spend that time, once again time, that they will never get back in the pages of this book or listening to it if they were to read this? And if the answer to both of those is yes, then boom, I'm all in and I start that process.
Oh, that's great. That's great. I think we got our first question right.
First question.
I'm going to stand up. And she's smart enough not to give me the microphone. If there's no other questions, I've got five or six questions. But I'd like to ask one on a commercial business perspective. And I'm going to ask you to maybe draw this out over the several books. When you identify particular equipment, platforms, products, is that something that you were able to go out and solicit and say, hey, I need to put this in my book? Are you interested? Or is this something that just from personal experience, how did you decide optic platforms or something like that?
Yeah, that might have been a smarter business move, but it's no, I just put in stuff that I like to use. I use them as character development tools. So sometimes if it's not my character, James Reese, not my protagonist, if it's somebody else and I want to paint a different picture, then I use different gear. Because what somebody uses, how they carry it, tells me a lot about them. Like we were just on a range down the hill here shooting a little earlier today, and I can tell if somebody walks up and they're in a leather belt, leather holster, cocked and locked 1911, tells me something about them. Or maybe it's a Kydex holster, Striker Fire. your words. Old school. Striker Fire pistol, Kydex holster, nylon belt, Salomon shoes. They're wearing a Black Rifle Coffee t-shirt. Are they wearing something that gives me the impression they've been to Afghanistan? Or they have tattoos or not? Those sorts of things. What kind of watch are they wearing? Is it a Casio? Is it a Rolex? You can really tell what kind of glasses are they wearing. Are those Gators? Are they Oakleys? Okay, like all these things tell me, are you Army? Are you Marine? Are you Navy? I can tell all those things. What year, what time frame were you in? I can tell those sorts of things. Have you continued your training or did you stall out in 1995, 2005? So it tells me something about them, or hey, does this guy person have no idea what they're doing at all? And with those ones, I'm a little more careful with the gear because I don't really, you don't want to throw these companies under the bus if you're like, oh, I would never wear that, never use that. Let's give it to somebody that has no idea what they're doing. So I'm a little more careful with those. But on all the other things, whether it's pistols and scopes and rifles and that sort of a thing, they're stuff that I use or trust. Or that I want to use and trust. It's just maybe it's still too expensive, that sort of a thing. And then I know who to call to talk about these weapon systems and get the specifics on them and then confirm things that I think I already know, because it's quite possible that I've been operating off faulty information for years on a couple. There was one acronym, I forget what it was, in the first book, and when I actually looked it up, I thought that it did something different for 20 years. So I do check these things. I do get emails quite often where people ask me that question and say, how much does it cost to get something in your book, or how much does it cost to get something in your gear guide, or how much does it cost to have you post about something on Instagram? And the answer is $0, because it's all it all has to remain authentic and true, because people are trusting me with that time. So I haven't taken so it's not a business thing. It's all character development tool. Yeah.
Excellent.
Got some more questions
in the back there, and we have one in the middle. So we'll go there and then here.
I was just wondering, with the next presidential election, can you see yourself publicly identifying with a candidate?
You said publicly identifying as, I was like, as what? I understand I can choose a lot of different things today. Probably. I mean, I'm definitely going to vote. That's my responsibility. I've never understood a lot of the military people that got so high in ranking and said they never voted. I was like, okay, I guess. But it just sounds like now a very convenient thing to say that you did because you wanted to maintain I didn't want to be biased. I'm certainly going in to vote. I always do. That's why, I mean, people died to give me that right. So I'm going in there to vote for sure. Will I go out and campaign for someone? I'm a little busy writing these books and juggling three kids and a dog and my wife and in-laws and all the rest of it. So I don't see myself getting into the political field either as a candidate or really to support anyone other than with donations. But I have a lot of friends getting into politics now, so I guess I shouldn't say that, because a lot of buddies from the military are getting into races, and if I know they're good people and I serve with them, for sure I'll do what I can for them.
I think we had another one right here, kind of in the middle.
Yes. Look at my eyes went this year.
So in the past we've seen in the series glimpses of Reese's father with the Wagoneer, the watch, leaving messages. You've talked on Andy Stump's podcast and with Joe today about branching off, maybe doing something else outside of this series. Have you thought about maybe a prequel series, more of like a period piece focusing on his father?
Yep, I sure have, and I did that intentionally, putting these little things here and there. I drop a few different events in there, particularly from the 80s, maybe late 70s, somewhere that I have a touch point, and so I can go back maybe and do it. And I got that one because I just like it, but Stephen Hunter, he did that in Point of Impact, and now that we're friends, I got to ask him about it, and I got to ask him, hey, did you mean to leave these little tiny hints here and there about the JFK assassination so that 15 years later, you could go and write the third bullet? And he said, no. He said, I had a bunch of JFK stuff in there, but the editor didn't like it. And so we went back and we took it all out. But that was the days before Word. You could just type in a word and, you know, pop up word search type of thing. So he's going through and he's taking out all the JFK stuff and he missed a few. And he's like, good thing I missed a few. So I was like, oh, geez, I'm glad you missed them too, because I put these in all my novels, little things here and there. And then the Hastings family, people really want to know about the Hastings family and Rhodesia, how they got to America and all these sorts of things. So I drop a lot more of that in this book. But I would love to do some work on that side of the house, on that family, on Reese's father, his grandfather. So it was very intentional, doing multi-generational little hints here and there so I could go back and explore. And then and I get asked about the nonfiction side of the house as well. And I'm not going to write a book about my time in the SEAL teams. Guys did so much more than I ever did or could have hoped to have done. But I am interested in exploring a few different things, namely different terrorist events that had an impact on my life, going into the history of them, maybe looking at them from a different perspective, from the enemy's perspective. So I'm looking at doing some things like that. So I have a bunch of projects out there that I want to do. But time management and prioritization. So I got to get a little bit more efficient with the day, because right now I still feel like it's a startup and I'm in the garage and it's just go, 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 and you're just building and you're building. But maybe it's to the point where I can take a breath and figure out a way to get a little more efficient with that time rather than running around like a crazy person every second of the day. And when I can do that, then these other projects, it'll be time. So it's pretty close. Actually, on the plane today, I was writing out exactly that. I was putting a timeline to a bunch of these other projects that I want to do. So that's in my notebook right now.
Yeah, excellent. So we had a couple more. Oh, we got one right back there. We might have time for one or two more questions.
Hi, Jack. Any words of wisdom to new college graduates?
New college graduates. Yes, read. Read, read, read. So I tell my kids, never miss an opportunity to make somebody's day. And I think we'd be a better country if we did that. Especially online, it's so easy for people to be mean online. But read, read, read. We tend to spend very little time putting the requisite energy effort into studying issues. It's much easier to retweet what someone else has put out there who also did not spend the time studying the issue. And that just makes this crazy cacophony of insanity out there. So really taking a break from that sort of thing, and I mean, that's really what we owe this next generation, future generations, is to study the past so we can draw lessons from it and apply them going forward as wisdom. So it's putting down the devices and getting into the history books and really studying an issue, taking a breath before making a comment on it or before injecting yourself into it. And that's I think that's what we owe. That's what we owe those people who gave us these freedoms, and that's what we owe this next generation, is really studying them before the loudest voice gets that like button or gets our retweet and makes things even worse.
Excellent. Let's see, we had another. Let's see, another one over here, kind of off to the side there, right there.
Hello. I was wondering, with your son having special needs, was that really the finer point of you writing and connecting with Freddie?
That's right. Yeah. So I didn't know whether to do that or not. One of the characters in my book has the same thing that our son has, which is a mutation of a gene that helps form the brain at birth. So it's a global developmental disability. So it's something that I knew, once again, like most things in the novels are things where I have personal touch points. To humanize him, obviously, I can add something from real life. So I added that to his character, which makes it all the worse if you've read the end of that novel. Yeah.
And then I think we have maybe our last one here, because we're coming up on time. So Laura, you got the mic. There's a couple of hands there. There we go.
Hi. How much did it hurt to write about the Land Cruiser being destroyed? Because that hurt.
Good question. Luckily, this is just fiction. Luckily, it's just fiction.
Still
in the driveway.
That hurt because I'm Central American, and in El Salvador, all everything's over. About Toyotas.
Yeah, yeah.
So reading about that, I was like, wait, he's driving a Jeep now? Are you kidding me?
I know, it's tough, it's tough. So yeah, that's still in the driveway, as is the one from the show. If you've seen that, there's a 20-second teaser out from the show, and there'll be another one coming out here very soon that's a little longer. But yeah, you can catch a glimpse of the Land Cruiser that they use. So that one is it should be on its way to the driveway right now. So yeah, I'm a fan.
Excellent. Well, we're gonna wrap up because you're gonna do some
signing. But you know, hey, before we do, there was one thing I wanted to say. And so the person who took my picture for the cover jacket, it's a new author photo. So his name is Mike Stoner, and he photographed the Reagans back in the late '80s, early '90s. A photographer out here in Los Angeles, and then went to Park City and does skiing and heli-skiing and that sort of kind of photography now. But he told me this story about Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan. And he said he was out here and they were at the ranch and he showed up and gets introduced and all that stuff. And he was with them for a while and he has such great memories of both of them. But he told me this one story. And he said he was with Ronald Reagan back here, and Nancy was up ahead with some sort of an aide or an assistant or something, and they're walking to one of the houses, and he said Ronald Reagan had these great jokes, and he was just such a wonderful human being, and then he looks up, and Nancy's getting close to the door, and he says, "Excuse me, Mike," and he jogs, runs up there, passes her, so that he can open the door for her, and I was like, "Wow, that just says it all right there."
Excellent, yeah. What a great story. What a great story. So, two quick things in wrapping up here. One, so Jack's going to be upstairs signing a book. If you haven't bought a copy yet, you can buy a copy here today. We hope you do. And don't be selfish. Buy multiple copies. Give them away to friends. You can do that. There's all sorts of Father's Day and that sort of thing is coming up, so it makes a good gift. It's a compelling read. So he'll be upstairs in just a few minutes doing that. And next, I just wanted to end by saying thank you. Ronald Reagan said that freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. And it's because of people like you who gave so much service to this country and now are giving back with these incredibly compelling novels. And I just want to say thank you for being here and thank you for your service.
Oh, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Signed copies of In the Blood can be purchased through the Reagan Library Museum Store. Every purchase you make from our catalog, website, or museum store is a critical component to our success. In short, your purchase supports our efforts to extend the legacy of President Ronald Reagan. Purchases can be made at reaganlibrary.com/store. To find a listing of all upcoming events, please visit reaganfoundation.org/events. Thank you for listening. For more information on the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute, including information on how to become a member, information on upcoming exhibits at the Reagan Library, and more information on the legacy of President Reagan, please visit reaganfoundation.org. And don't forget to like and follow the Reagan Foundation on all social media platforms.
Until next week, thanks for listening, and God bless you.
Don't forget to subscribe to A Reagan Forum podcast in your iTunes or Google Play stores and on other podcast platforms as they become available. New episodes of A Reagan Forum come out every Thursday. Like what you hear? Check out our Words to Live By podcast featuring radio addresses and speeches Ronald Reagan delivered from the 1960s through the 1980s. New episodes drop every Tuesday. And don't forget to follow @Ronald Reagan on Facebook, @Ronald Reagan on Twitter, and Reagan Foundation on YouTube. Also, search for us on SoundCloud and Stitcher.